And today we talk about Meltdown, and probably you all know the paper. So we'll discuss the basics and also the new things that we added to the final version. So I encourage you to read also the final version that you find here at Usenix. So let's start right off. We all know virtual memory, and until very recently, the kernel addresses, the air kernel, was also mapped in the virtual address space of the user. So if you want to read some kernel memory, you can just go pick an address, for instance, something human readable, like the Linux version string, get the address, do some pointer magic in C, dereference the address, and read the value. So, of course, this does not work. So an exception will be thrown. You cannot just read the value. A segmentation fault occurs. It's not that easy, because we have memory isolation on our computers. So the kernel is isolated from the user space, and this isolation is a combination of hardware and software. And user applications cannot just access anything from the kernel. Otherwise, everything will be really broken. In order to support multiple processes, we use paging. So we have a virtual address space to isolate those processes from each other. And the physical memory is then organized in so-called page frames. We use page tables to map those virtual addresses to the actual physical memory that we have. And on x86, this looks like the following. So we have multiple levels of page tables, and certain bits of the virtual address are used as indices for those tables to translate to the final physical page. And if we take a closer look at the page table entry in the end, we can see that we find there the actual physical address and, in addition, some interesting bits. For instance, the page present bit or also the user mode accessible bit, where you can define if this page is accessible on which privilege level. In addition, typically the kernel is mapped into every address space, as we've seen in the beginning. But moreover, the entire physical memory is also mapped in the kernel. So for instance, if we have a user space address in this graphic, we also have an additional virtual address that points to the same physical address in the main memory. So with the previous example, if we just try to read an address, we will get the permission check, which checks this bit in the page table entry. It will say, no, you cannot read this address, so we will fail. So on the architectural level, everything works as intended. So the instruction set architecture is an abstract model of our computer, which serves as an interface between the hardware and the software. And the microarchitecture that is executing our instructions is now the actual implementation of this instruction set, and they can be quite different to each other. So you all know, for instance, AMD Athlon CPUs, Ryzen, Intel Core i7, Intel Xeon, and so on. But this all happens on the microarchitectural level, so we cannot easily observe what's going on there. But we have those side-channel attacks. So even if we have a safe software infrastructure where we do not have any bugs, the hardware that executes our software can leak information. And using these side-channel attacks, we can exploit this unintentional information leakage by observing those side effects. This could be the power consumption of the device. So the power consumption is increased depending on what values you are processing, or the execution time of the algorithm, or also the CPU cache, which we'll take a look at now. So if you have an address, for instance, of this variable I, and you want to access it the first time, you won't find it in the CPU cache. So you have a cache miss. Now the CPU needs to request this address from the main memory. It will be loaded from the main memory directly into the cache. And the next time when we try to access this address, it is already stored in the cache. So we have a so-called cache hit. So if we have no DRAM access, the access time to this address is served is much faster. If we have a cache miss, we need to access the DRAM, so this is slower. And if you have a high-resolution dimer, you can easily measure that and get a histogram like this. So it's easy to find a threshold between those two peaks, which allows you to distinguish between a cache hit and a cache miss. And only with this information, an attacker can build powerful attacks, like the flush and reload attack we've seen earlier. So we assume shared memory between an attacker process and the victim process, which means that if an address is cached for one, it's cached basically for both of them because it's shared memory. Now, the attacker can flush the address from the cache, so the next time someone loads it, it will be served from memory. Now, assume the victim is scheduled and tries to access this address. Since it's not in the cache, it will be loaded into the cache by the access of the victim. Now, if the attacker measures the execution time, how long it takes to access this address again, he can deduce if the victim has accessed the address in the meantime or if the victim did not access this address in the meantime. And with this, as we've seen with different cache attacks, an attacker can break crypto and so on. But what is actually happening when we execute some instructions on our high-performance CPUs that we have nowadays? There, we use out-of-order executions, which means instructions are fetched and decoded in the front end, which we see in the upper part of the picture, and then they are dispatched to the back end. And there, we have individual execution units that then process those instructions. So we have some units for ALU operations, or to load an address, or to store operations. What's more important is that now instructions can be executed out of order. This means they can wait until the dependencies are ready. And what this means is that instructions that would occur later in your instruction stream can be actually executed before other instructions. The important thing is that those instructions are retired in order, because otherwise our programs wouldn't work as expected. And only while retiring, the state becomes architecturally visible. If an exception occurs, they are checked during the retirement. If so, we can just flush the pipeline and recover the same state that we had before. But as I said, what's more important, the state becomes only architecturally visible when those instructions are retired. So we have a little toy example on how we can check things out, what they are working. So in this example, we just have a null pointer access, which will raise an exception. So the next instruction, the access to the array, should never be executed. But if we run this code and then use the flush and reload attack that we've seen earlier and iterate over all those pages in the array, we suddenly see a cache hit. What does this mean? So apparently, unreachable code was actually executed. And the exception was only thrown afterwards. So with that information, we know that out-of-order instructions leave microarchitectural traces. And we can see them, for example, also in the cache. From now on, we give those instructions the name of transient instructions. And we can indirectly observe the execution of those instructions, which brings us to the building blocks of our attack. So assume we have somewhere a secret, which we want as an attacker to extract from the system. So we execute some transient instructions that access the secret and introduce a microarchitectural state change, which also works as the sender of a cover channel. And then we need to transfer this microarchitectural state change to an architectural state, because otherwise we cannot really observe it. And with this state, we then can recover the secret that we have accessed in those transient instructions. So the first thing that we need to do, we need to execute such transient instructions. But in fact, they are executed all the time, as we have seen in our toy example. But as we have also seen in the beginning, loading an inaccessible address leads to a crash, in this case, to a segmentation fault. So at one point, we need to prevent the crash, because otherwise our attacker application is just terminated and we cannot do anything. And there are different things that we can do. For instance, we can do fault handling. So we just install a signal handler that will catch the segmentation fault and jump back to our code and continues the execution. Or we could use Intel TSX, as we've seen in the previous presentation, to suppress the fault entirely. Because when the exception is happening there, the transaction will just be aborted and we can continue. Or we can use the Spectre attacks by exploiting speculative execution to execute those instructions speculatively, and we have the same result. So the second thing is, here we directly access the secret, so we do not really use a side channel. But then, on the other hand, we establish a covert channel, where we transfer the microarchitectural state change into the architectural state. And the transient instruction sequence serves here as the sender. The receiver then, by iterating over those pages and reloading those pages and measuring the time, receives the state change because the page is now cached and deduces the secret from this state. But what is important is that we here leverage the cache attack technique flush and reload. We can also use it to transmit multiple bits at once. So we encode the byte that we read into 256 different cache lines that we access. But what's really important is it's not limited to the cache. So you can use also other parts of the microarchitecture to transmit a secret, as we've seen in the NetSpectre attack, for instance. So to build our final attack, we just need another layer of indirection. This time, we use the value that we read from this inaccessible address and use it as the index of the access to the array. So when we then check whether any part of the array is cached, we see that we indeed have a cache hit, and the index of the cache hit reveals the data that we are not supposed to read. So sometimes the permission check is apparently not fast enough, and we have the meltdown attack. So with meltdown, we exploit out-of-order execution to read data at any address. We use the index of the cache hit to reveal the data, and the permission check is not fast enough. And since the entire physical memory is mapped into the kernel, we can just dump the entire physical memory, as we can see in this demo. So we just start to read at any address, at a random address, and in this case, we read descriptions of packages for the package manager on the system. But if you read the reports in January, Intel said you can only read values that are stored in the L1 cache. But we don't think that's the case. So we also did a new experiment in addition in the new paper, where a thread constantly flushes the value and a thread on a different core reloads the value. This means that the targeted data is not in the L1 cache of the attacking core. But still, we can leak the data, but at a lower reading rate. So we are much faster if it's in the L1, but slower if it's not. So meltdown might implicitly cache the data. But we can even go one step further. We can use uncacheable memory. So one bit in the page tables, as we've seen, can be used to mark a page as uncacheable. This means that every read or write operation will go directly to main memory. And we observe that if the attacker can trigger a legitimate load, like through a system call, to this address on the same CPU core, you can still leak the data. So meltdown might read the data now not from the cache, because it's uncacheable, but of one of the fill buffers. And those fill buffers are shared between threads running on the same core. So who is affected? For Intel, almost every CPU seems to be affected, and we tested many of them. But for AMD, no microarchitecture seems to be affected, which is nice. ARM stated that only the Cortex-A75 is affected. For IBM, it's the power architecture, system set, and so on. And for Apple, all Mac and iOS devices seem to be affected. But there are also some other CPU manufacturers which didn't state which of their devices are affected. And it appears that also the Samsung Galaxy S7 using the Exynos Mongoose M1 CPU chip seems to be affected, and it's the first custom CPU core in the Exynos 8 Octa with a Perceptron branch prediction, full out-of-order instruction execution, and full out-of-order loads and stores. And as you see in the paper, we also were able to mount a meltdown attack on that device. But how does the practice look like? So dumping the entire physical memory takes some time, because not everything fits into the L1, where we have the most highest speed achieved with 582 kilobytes per second on average. In the L3, it was only 12.4. If it's uncached, it was like 10 bytes per second, and in the improved version, around 3.2 kilobyte. So it's not very practical in most scenarios where you just want to dump the entire physical memory of a machine. But you can also do more targeted attacks. So we have also KSLR on our systems, so we can also use it to break KSLR to access internal kernel structures that we can use to mount more targeted attacks. So we try to locate a known value inside the kernel, like the Linux banner as we've seen earlier, and we start at the default address according to the symbol table of the running kernel. So you need to know the version of the kernel running on the system, but for each Linux distribution, this is the same. Since KSLR has only an entropy of 6 bits, there are only 64 possible randomization offsets, and we can just try all of them. And the difference between the found address, where we can read the leaked value, and the non-randomized base address is now our randomization offset. With that, we broke KSLR, so we know exactly where the identity mapping starts, and we can use this to go on and, for instance, locate a victim process. So in Linux, all processes are managed in a linked list, and the head of the list is stored in the init task structure. And this is at a fixed offset that varies also among the Linux kernels. And each task list structure contains a pointer to the next task, and also the process ID, the name, and also the root of the multi-level page table. So we can search this structure using Meltdown to find the process we want to target. We can then use the physical address using the paging structures to read directly the memory of this process, and then read the content using the directed physical map with our physical address. We can just enumerate all mapped pages and dump the entire process memory. So we do not need to dump the entire physical memory anymore. And if we know the location of the key, for instance, that we want to extract, we can just dump the key directly. So how can we solve that? The problem is rooted in the hardware that we have. And it's a race condition between the permission check and the memory fetch. So we can just serialize them, then we do not have that problem. Or we can introduce a hard split of the user space and the kernel space, where we fix the kernel to the upper half of the address space and the user to the lower half. And we just introduce a new bit to be backwards compatible to figure out if we have this active. But fixing the hardware is a long-term solution, so we need a solution in software. And as you remember earlier, this is how the address space looked like. We had the kernel space mapped in there, and the big problem is that when we are running in user mode, we also have the kernel mapped. So we should get rid of the kernel while running in user mode. And this is actually what the Kaiser paper did. So whenever you have a context switch and running in user mode, you unmap the entire kernel, and therefore also the identity mapping, and then you cannot read anything anymore if you mount Meltdown, or so we thought until very recently. So Kaiser has been published in the summer of 2017 at the ESOS conference, and it was initially proposed as a countermeasure against other side channel attacks. But since this massive change to the operating system, where we do not have anything mapped anymore, brings also the profit that it also defeats Meltdown in this case. So Meltdown then has been improved, so the Kaiser batch of the Kaiser paper has been improved and then merged into the Linux kernel under the name KPTI. Apple also released some updates, and Windows have also their implementation with the same principles called Kernel Virtual Address Shadow. And also for Samsung, the patches have been rolled out last month, so it's also fixed there. We have a proof of concept implementation of our code online, so you can check out the GitHub repository and try to run it on your machine. Hopefully, you already have the patches, so you would need to disable the mitigations, but you can go and play with that. So to conclude, we underestimated microarchitectural attacks for a long time. And with Meltdown, that we have seen that we can read arbitrary kernel memory from user space without any privileges or permissions. It affected millions of devices from various CPU manufacturers, and the countermeasure that we have implemented comes with a performance impact. So I invite you to check out also the next talk, because it brings some nice new insights. And thank you for your attention, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Questions?
Hi, Yongjin Jang from Oregon State University. Hi. Impressive work. And I have tried to replicate the Meltdown attack again and again. And
okay.
Definitely with the L1 cache hit, it works very well.
Yeah.
But I'm very surprised that the uncached attack also works. So could you share a little bit of details of how can you make the successful attack in 10 bytes a second? That's quite impressive because...
Yeah.
Is it something like just trying the address multiple times when then you eventually get something, or can
so
you
apparently it also
like
gets area? Moved into the cache at some point, but there are some other tricks that you could do when you mount the Meltdown attack. One we presented at Black Hat last week. It's not intuitive, but you just, before accessing the address you're not allowed to access, you access a null pointer. And with that, you increase the chance to read the actual value significantly.
So is your answer something like the Intel processor will eventually cache the somewhat uncached memory in transient
You mean uncacheable memory or uncached memory?
Uncacheable.
So uncacheable memory should not ever be pulled into the cache. But as we've seen, it could be directly served from the line buffer. So there are more constraints in mounting the attack with uncacheable memory.
Yes.
So you need to run on the same physical core because those line buffers are shared on there, otherwise it won't work. So you need to pin your attack code on those cores.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Other questions? Okay, so let's thank Moritz again.